Earlier, we heard from Dr. King's letter written in 1963. A year later, white churches were still grappling with how to support the civil rights movement, which is ongoing today in the Black Lives Matter movement and others. In April of 1964, when the Senate was filibustering a vote on the Civil Rights Act, the National Council of Churches Commission on Religion and Race convened the Church Assembly on Civil Rights in Washington, D.C. This assembly promised to engage with senators on a daily basis for as long as it would take to end the filibuster. Today's sermon was written by my stepfather, Reverend James A. McNeely, in response to Dr. King's letter and calling on church members to follow the lead of the Church Assembly on Civil Rights by writing to their senators in support of the Civil Rights Act. This was a critical time in our nation's history, and this sermon provides some backstory on how white churches and clergy in America helped this historic legislation get passed. As a result of this momentous event nearly 55 years ago, we share with you this sermon on freedom's unfinished business.
Good morning.
Good morning.
History would mark it. The summer of 1963 was a time of revolution. The season when 19 million U.S. Negroes demanded payment on the century-old promissory note called the Emancipation Proclamation. And the demand for payment has continued and will continue until fulfilled. Lincoln's proclamation epitomizes in the history of blacks in America the break from the long, dark past of slavery and the beginning of freedom. It was the beginning not only of the first realistic hope, but in fact, the continuity of family and society, of memory, and group self-consciousness as well. But a broader significance lies in the meaning of emancipation for the American people as a whole and for the institutions of society they had vainly attempted to shape after the democratic and Christian ideal under the impossible compromise of caste. Here, too, was a beginning, a simple act that ended all argument, even if it did not end the war. For from that point on, the nation turned its direction, however imperfectly and twisting, toward the practical demands of full and equal citizenship. Shortly after the end of the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Constitutional Amendments were passed, which respectively outlawed slavery forever, granted the same full rights to all citizens, assured equal protection of the law, and firmly established the right to vote. The 14th Amendment became for all citizens the hallmark of constitutional protection of individual civil rights. Emancipation and the Civil Rights Amendments established a new and determinative benchmark of American public policy. But their enactment did not bring to fruition the purpose of full and equal rights for the American Negro. Well-intended Reconstruction reforms were short-lived. Political redemption of the South ensured under the slogan of white supremacy. Violence and intimidation emerged as a deliberate form of social control in keeping the Negro in his place. Segregation laws and forms of racial etiquette, which were far more encompassing but equally punitive, became the order of the day. The first 50 years after the emancipation were in reality a kind of dark age. Nothing of significance took place. Not a single important gain in public policy, legislation, or judicial decision. The seeds of change were planted, however, by the great impersonal forces that emerged from two world wars, a sustained and major period of economic depression, accelerating industrialization, increased bargaining strength, and organizational growth of labor, heightened international dependence, and a worldwide drive towards independence by former colonies. While the late 1950s, a meaningful progress was made toward basic equality of rights and opportunities, student sit-in movements swept parts of the country to set a tone of aggressiveness that affected black leadership at all levels and in all parts of the country. In the clear, candid simplicity of their appeals, the proponents of nonviolent direct action bypassed the niceties of debate and hair-splitting, which had become sloganized in the desegregation controversy as moderation and gradualism. Even more, they raised a single standard of morality and expectation in the insistence that the purpose of their movement lay in the absolute claim of personal dignity denied to them by the racial system in all of its manifestations, including that of the institutional church. The youth were proof of the observation made by Alexis de Tocqueville more than 100 years before, that the passion for equality in democracies is ardent, insatiable, and invincible. A little bit of equality and freedom will no longer suffice. Indeed, if it ever did. Martin Luther King so eloquently put it, America has given the Negro people a bad check. It has come back marked insufficient funds. This in no time to engage the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro was granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. There will be no turning back the clock to a romantic past of leisurely change and the granting of opportunity through a sitting down of benefits from a monopolized surplus. The demands of black leadership will increase, and they will cover the tragic disparity of opportunity in the employment, housing, and other welfare fields, in addition to the unfilled gaps of civil rights. Religious bodies in America have not been faithful to their prophetic mission on the question of racial justice. In the midst of a nation rife with racial animosity, the church too often has been content to mouth pious irrelevance and sanctimonious trivialities. Called to combat social evils, it has often remained silent behind the anesthetizing security of stained glass windows. Called to lead us on the highway of brotherhood and to summon us to rise above the narrow confines of race and class, the church has often been an active participant in shaping and crystallizing the patterns of the race caste system. It has so often cast the mantle of its sanctity over the system of segregation and inequality. And if the church does not recapture its prophetic zeal, it will become little more than an irrelevant social club with a thin veneer of religiosity. If the church does not participate actively in the struggle for economic and racial justice, where to say that its will has atrophied? We can thank God for the worldwide awakening of Christian conscience on the sin of discrimination. From every quarter of the globe comes the awareness that some of the most disturbing and potentially far-reaching conflicts revolve around racial injustices. Every section of the United States faces tensions due to racial or ethnic differences. The struggle for justice and dignity, equality before the law in voting, housing, education, and public accommodations and employment, as well as for a community of concern human beings, not only may but do live together as brothers and sisters, has never become more urgent or widespread than now. No local church faces this problem alone. The message of the church universal is clear beyond doubt. The World and National Councils of Churches, of which our own denomination is a part, call upon all Christians to obey, as well as to proclaim the judgment of God who made us one, and in whose holy sight all hatred and recrimination are sinful. We are called upon to reject racial or ethnic fears and prejudices and to recognize them as sinful. They separate each of us from God, and they separate us from each other. We are called upon to reject racial segregation in all forms because it is the creature of these evil fears. The duty of issuing this challenge to the conscience of mankind cannot be limited to pulpit utterances. It rests upon the entire church and each one in the pew, laity and clergy alike. Words alone will not do, for we must be ready to understand and to extend support to those who seek just and effective ways out of the darkness of this problem. We must continue the struggle now visible in the communions in this land to remove every trace of segregation from their structure and in life. There can be no turning back from this call and commitment. Difficult as the way ahead may seem, every other way is not only sinful, it is suicidal. The work at hand is clear. And it is not our work we seek to do. It is the work of Jesus who called us into the life of the Christian community. We seek the things that make for peace among humanity, in our common life, its values, relationships, institutions, laws, and conventions give clear and convincing witness to our oneness with all people in Jesus Christ. The initiative rests. The initiative in this rests with those who see and feel the shame of separation and who recognize that the words we use in worship become the words we must face in judgment. First, be reconciled to your adversary. Will we continue to bless the status quo that needs to be blasted and continue to reassure a social order that needs to be reformed? Or will we give ourselves unreservedly to God's kingdom? Will we continue to march to the drumbeat of conformity and respectability? Or will we, risking criticism and abuse, march to the soul-saving music of eternity? Dr. Martin Luther King spoke of his dream in these words: "I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, all people, all human beings, all men and women, brothers and sisters, are created equal." In closing, please let me read the statement drawn up by leaders in our own and other religious bodies. "The religious conscience of America condemns racism as blasphemy against God. It recognizes that the racial segregation and discrimination that flow from it are a denial of the worth which God has given to all persons. We hold that God is the creator of all. Consequently, in every person, there is an innate dignity which is the basis of human rights. These rights constitute a moral claim which must be honored by both all persons and by the state. Denial of such rights is immoral and unchristian." Thank you, Church.